Please open your Bibles to Exodus chapter 24. Exodus 24. This is another sermon in the series I'm calling Bible Sidekicks. Sidekick is a colloquial way of saying a close comrade or a companion, a faithful man or woman who helps someone else do a job that needs to be doing or face a challenge, or who's in some instances just present to be with that person. Now, the Bible has a number of different sidekicks. Why do I think it's a good idea to study Bible sidekicks? Well, for one thing, they're part of the Bible story, and we can learn from their lives the way we can learn from the better-known Bible people, their sidekicks too. But for another thing, those major leaders like Moses and so on, these people were God's sidekicks. If you just run down the list of the famous Bible names, you realize that they all did what they did as servants of God. They weren't calling the shots. God was. God said there'd be a flood. Noah built a boat. Noah built a boat. God told Abraham to leave southern Iraq and head out toward a distant promised land that he didn't even know where was when God said to leave. And Abraham packed up and left. The Israelites demanded their first human king, and Samuel knew this was not God's first plan, but when God said to let it happen, the prophet followed instructions. So in the Bible, everyone who was on God's side and who helped work out God's plan was God's sidekick, God's comrade, God's close companion. Last week, we started looking at the early ministry of Joshua, and as I mentioned, long before he marched the people around Jericho and caused the sun to stand still, the Bible has a lot to say about Moses' trusted associate. Too much for one sermon. In fact, this, I couldn't even cover all the material in this sermon, so we will have one more sermon this coming week. And last week I started in the sermon a list of qualities which Joshua had, qualities I believe you and I need to develop or strengthen as we serve the Lord. In a way, you and I need to position ourselves to be today's Joshuas. Why is that? Because back in Joshua's time, God was getting ready to lead the people into the promised land. And according to Bible prophecy, God is doing the same thing today. He needs all the Joshuas he can get. We spent a good portion of time in our Sabbath school class talking about how at a person's workplace, they have an influence. People told stories about how they felt as though their influence, their Christian influence, was making a dent in the people around them, even though you may not even be able to actually talk to somebody about Christianity. And we just need to remember that. So last week I listed the first two of Joshua's sidekick qualities, the ones I thought were his sidekick qualities. These were sermon points 1 and 2, and here they are. The first sidekick quality Joshua lived by, as we talked about last week, was to become part of God's woodwork. What do I mean by that? Someone who is part of the woodwork is faithful and dependable, always shows up to help, and that's what Joshua was. I mentioned last week that the first time Joshua was mentioned in the Bible, he's not introduced by telling us who he's the son of or even the tribe he was part of. That comes later. Joshua was so familiar, so much part of the woodwork already, that his name came to Moses' pen just naturally as someone who was just part of the operation. Every church, including this one, has people you can't imagine the church without. Think back to the church you attended in your childhood, whether it was an Adventist church or another church, and you will think of people who made it their highest priority Sabbath morning to be there on time and change things for the better. They weren't sleepers in on Sabbath morning. They weren't, oh, I don't feel like going to church today people. Instead, they were, church isn't just for me, it's for other people, and we all need to be encouragers type of people. Like Joshua, we need to be faithfully, steadily, dependably present. We need to show up. Last week, we also looked at Joshua's second sidekick principle. Joshua's second sidekick principle is to become a rememberer. Become a rememberer. One of the most chilling facts you discover when you read the Old Testament is how quickly people forget what God had done for them, how they forgot back there. During the time Joshua was Moses' assistant, every other adult in that traveling nation had seen exactly what Joshua saw. They had seen the plagues the nation of Egypt suffered. Their sandals had pressed the dry ground underneath the Red Sea while the walls of water towered on either side. Daily they saw the pillar of cloud in the daytime, and they had seen it change to an illuminating pillar of fire at night. They saw what Joshua saw, but when a challenge arose, these people allowed their fears to loom large and eclipse their memories. Joshua did not. Joshua remembered what God had done, and that memory was so vivid that it loomed large and eclipsed any current challenge. And that's what you and I need to do as well. As sidekicks, as God's assistant to the God of heaven, we need to remember what he has done for us and keep those memories fresh and large so that challenges do not eclipse them. So now let's continue Joshua's sidekick story and find out what else we need to do to be God's assistants, God's sidekicks here on earth. This third principle I found is an especially important one. If we can make this one part of our lives the way Joshua made it a part of his, this will make us far more dependable sidekicks. Exodus 24, verse 12. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Come up to me on the mountain and be there, and I will give you tablets of stone and the law and commandments which I have written, that you may teach them." Remember, this is Exodus 24. Four chapters back in Exodus 20, God came down on the top of Mount Sinai. The sound of loud and supernatural trumpet blasted from that mountain, which caught the people's attention. And then the very voice of God spoke from the top of that mountain. Can you imagine what it must have been like to listen to the audible voice of the Creator? But then God must have realized that simply speaking these commandments aloud wouldn't fix them in people's minds. Sinful people are tempted to be forgetful rather than rememberers. So God called Moses up to the mountain. So Moses, God's faithful sidekick, obeys God's request, and notice who else he takes with him. Verse 13, chapter 24, verse 13. So Moses arose with his assistant Joshua. And Moses went up to the mountain of God, and he said to the elders, "Wait here for us until we come back to you. Indeed, Aaron and Hur are with you. If any man has a difficulty, let him go to them." To me, this is very interesting. Moses did not ask Aaron to come with him. Why not? Aaron was his brother. Aaron had been his spokesperson to Pharaoh. But Moses passed over Aaron and told Joshua to come with him. Part of the reason, of course, might have been that Aaron was needed down in the camp to keep order and reassure people, help solve disputes. And another part of the reason might have been that God had decided that Joshua, a younger man, should be the next leader once Moses was gone. But quite frankly, Joshua was a steadier sidekick than Aaron ever was. But anyway, Joshua comes along with Moses, and we don't hear anything more about Joshua throughout this entire mountaintop experience until the very end when he accompanies Moses back down the mountain. We don't know what Joshua was doing. We don't know whether he brought food along with him or what he did, but he seems not to have been bored. What was he doing? The Bible doesn't say. Anyway, a lot has been happening up there on the mountain. God has handwritten the Ten Commandments on two slabs of stone, and then God gives Moses some basic instructions about the wilderness tent sanctuary he wants Moses to supervise the construction for. The reason for that sanctuary is that God wants to be close to his people. He doesn't want to be far away. He wants to get as close as he possibly can. But suddenly, there's a tragic setback. Exodus 32, starting with verse 1. Exodus 32, starting with verse 1. Now, when the people saw that Moses delayed coming down from the mountain, the people gathered together to Aaron and said to him, come, make us gods that shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what's become of him. And Aaron said to them, break off the golden earrings which are in the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me. This was jewelry from the Egyptians, Egyptians had given them a lot of jewelry before they took off. So out comes that jewelry. And all the people broke off the golden earrings which were in their ears and brought them to Aaron, and he received the gold from their hand, and he fashioned it with an engraving tool and made a molded calf. Then they said, this is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt. And then God and Moses, so we have this tragic sidekick. Oh, here, Mr. Sermon Page. Here we are. Get it straight. Well, what happened? I don't know. I hope there are no more sermon pages missing. So here is Aaron, the high priest, allowing the people to convince him to break commandment number two so that the people can break commandment number one. Aaron Moses' other sidekick turns out not to be a rememberer the way Joshua was. Verse 7, chapter 32, verse 7. Then the Lord said to Moses, go, get down, for your people whom you brought out of the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves. They have turned aside quickly out of the way which I commanded them. They have made themselves a molded calf and worshipped it and sacrificed to it and said, this is your God, O Israel, who brought you out of the land of Egypt. And then God and Moses have a very tense argument. Can we allow the Lord to become emotionally honest or honestly emotional, either way, about those he cares so much for? Last night, Shelley and I attended the Puget Sound Adventist Academy's senior recognition event. Some of the evening's most touching moments were when one by one the pictures of each senior, several pictures of each senior were flashed on the screen, starting from babyhood up, saw the little tiny babies and they were growing, the photos that showed their growth. While the pictures were being shown, the recorded voices of the parents were heard expressing their love for their child and their hopes for his or her future. And these parents knew, and sometimes they even hinted at it, that these growing up years weren't always smooth ones. There were times when earnest discussions happened between parent and child, even times when mom or dad might have frankly despaired at the way things were going. But still, their love stayed true, and last night it showed in their voices and in what they said. I think whenever we read of God being riled up or angry or deeply emotional, we need to remember that this is an expression of the deepest love possible. God's anger is not like our anger. Our anger is selfish. Our anger is injured. We feel an injury to our own selves. But God's anger comes from the deepest love possible and the desire that everyone should come to a knowledge that will save them in the end. God has bought into us. God would eventually become human and die for us. That's what kind of love God has. But here, God gives Moses the bad news about what the people are doing down there at the base of the mountain. Watch Joshua. He follows Moses as the aging leader staggered down the trail carrying these stone slabs. I thought not long ago that Joshua maybe helped him carry these rocks, these slabs. But no, it just says Moses was the one who carried them. Suddenly Joshua hears something, verse 15, chapter 32, verse 15. And Moses turned and went down from the mountain, and the two tablets of the testimony were in his hand. The tablets were written on both sides, on the one side and on the other. They were written. Now the tablets were the work of God, and the writing was the writing of God engraved on the tablets. And when Joshua heard the noise of the people as they shouted, he said to Moses, "There's a noise of war in the camp." Isn't that interesting? That shows Joshua was not in the loop about this. Here he'd patiently waited on the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights, just like Moses, and we're assuming that he heard nothing. He experienced nothing. He was away from the conversation God was having with Moses. And he is so clueless that when he comes down the mountain with Moses, he thinks he hears a war going on. Well, Moses quickly fills him in on what's happening, and the two men arrive at the base of the mountain, sees the pagan party, and Moses raises those slabs of stone over his head one by one and throws them down and shatters them. Then he eventually goes back up and talks this great sin over with God, begs God to continue to accompany them in their travel through the desert. God is about ready to write him off. He's saying, okay, forget this. You guys go ahead. I'm not coming with you, because if I come with you, it's going to be dangerous. So just go. Let's get out of here. But let's keep our eye on Joshua now. Watch what happens in the next chapter. Here is something I did not remember happening when I read this story before. Remember, God has been sharing sanctuary plans, tabernacle designs with Moses up there on the mountain. But of course, nobody but Moses has seen those plans yet, has those plans yet. So watch what happens. Exodus 33, verse 7. Exodus 33, 7. Moses took his tent, and pitched it outside the camp, far from the camp, safe distance, and called it the Tabernacle of Meeting. I did not know Moses had done that. Until the sanctuary tabernacle was built, Moses used his own tent for that. And it came to pass that everyone who sought the Lord, see, this is a serious time of soul searching. People have discovered that God is very, very angry about this, and some emphatic things have been happening here. So everybody gets serious. And it came to pass that everyone who sought the Lord went out to the tabernacle of meeting, which was outside the camp. So it was whenever Moses went out to the tabernacle that all the people rose, and each man stood at his tent door and watched Moses until he'd gone into the tabernacle, which is his own tent. And it came to pass when Moses entered the tabernacle that the pillar of cloud descended and stood at the door of the tabernacle, and the Lord talked with Moses. And all the people saw the pillar of cloud standing at the tabernacle door, and all the people rose and worshiped each man in his tent door. So this is a sobered up bunch of people now. During this time of soul searching and repentance for the nation, Moses actually used his own tent for the sanctuary tabernacle. He would go there, talk with God, and then come back to the people. But notice what Joshua was doing, verse 11, chapter 33, verse 11. So the Lord spoke to Moses face to face, as a man speaks to his friend, and he would return to the camp, but his servant Joshua, the son of Nun, a young man, did not depart from the tabernacle. See what's happening here? Not only had Joshua become part of God's woodwork, faithful, so present, so dependable, and not only was Joshua a rememberer of the powerful deeds God had done, but Joshua had learned to be hungry for God's presence. Each time Moses came out from his conversation with God, he headed back to the camp. Joshua could have simply fallen in step beside him or behind him, but Joshua hungered to be in God's presence. Notice that it also says that Joshua was a young man. Moses was old, at least 80, but Joshua was young. At a very early age, Joshua fully and completely devoted himself to God. Joshua was faithful, Joshua was a rememberer, and Joshua wanted to be in God's presence. Okay, how can we put this into practice here in the frantic 21st century we live in? Well, we can follow Joshua's first two steps. We can be present and helpful in this house of worship or wherever God also asks us to serve elsewhere. We can refresh our memories of God's goodness. We can remember Bible stories that I myself get something new out of each time I go through them, like this one. We can listen to the encouraging experience we hear in Sabbath school classes and in celebrations and concerns time here, and add those experiences to our memory banks so that when challenge comes, the experiences and the stories of how God has led us loom large and bring the challenge down to its proper perspective rather than the other way. The Bible tells us how deep God's love is for us. Last night, there was at the senior recognition, there was a little program. As soon as we came in the door, we were handed a little long program. On the one side, it had the order of service for that night's event. And on the other side, it had the lists of the class members, and if they had a class office, the title would be put beside it. And I ran my eye down the list, and about three from the bottom, there was the name of a girl, and beside her name, the person typing it meant to type treasurer, but they left off the last letter. And so here you have this little girl right beside her name, treasure. And that is true for every single one of those kids last night. They could have put treasure beside each one. God cares for us. We are God's treasure. When I make up my jewels, he said, and there's a children's song, they shall shine in his beauty, bright gems for his crown. We are treasures to God. And we just frankly need to follow through on Joshua's third step. We need to learn to hunger for the presence of God. And the best way, maybe the only way, to develop this hunger is to settle down and read large passages of the Bible. Even though the Sabbath school lessons are wonderful, there are only quick outlines. I was wondering how they were going to do Revelation in one quarterly. They can't do Revelation in one quarterly. They hit the high spots. But we need to, and they're just quick outlines of some deep biblical ideas. Because we develop this hunger for God's presence through reading incidents like the one I just talked about. When Moses uses his own personal tent as a tabernacle, and then goes into that tent to talk with God, then goes out to tell the people what he's heard, how's God's attitude toward them. God was basically cooling his righteous wrath at that point, and Moses goes out to the people to kind of keep them posted. And Joshua stays right there in that tent. Again, God is not speaking to him the way he speaks to Moses, but Joshua wants to be in God's presence. Even though this is a time of spiritual crisis, when God's parental emotions are aroused, Joshua is not afraid of him. You might want to try an experiment I do once in a while. Start with the tiny books of the Bible, like the Minor Prophets and the Old Testament, in the Old Testament, Paul's smaller books, and the New Testament, little books of 1st, 2nd, 3rd John. Read them through one by one at one sitting, like take some Sabbath afternoon and just read 1st John or just read 2nd John. And when you get done with it, take another Bible version and read that book again. You can find several versions online. For one thing, you'll be getting away from, by doing that, you'll be getting away from the idea that the Bible can best be learned by the cut and paste system. A verse here, a phrase there, half a verse over here, join them together, get a truth. That's not the way to do it. With a crossword puzzle, and not a crossword, but with a regular puzzle, you can't easily see the whole beautiful picture by looking at just one piece, or maybe if you had five pieces together, you can't get the whole picture. You got to put the whole puzzle together. I think it's only when you read large parts of the Bible, get into the habit of doing that, that you can really start to feel God's metaphorical heartbeat. Most of you know how Shelley and I became acquainted. A magazine editor friend of ours decided that we should write to each other. I was in Nebraska, Shelley was in Alaska, didn't know each other at all. Shelley's letters, that when we started writing, were long and full of news. But when I received each of those letters, here's what I didn't do. I didn't flick through them and say, oh, here's a nice sentence on page 4. Shelley would write long letters, there were 17 pages, 22. 25, both sides of a legal pad sheets. I didn't just say, here's a nice sentence on page 4, I'm going to read that today. Or here's a shortish paragraph over on page 6, I'll read that one before I head out the door. No, you know what I did. I read each letter from start to finish, and that's the way I got acquainted with her personality and character and found that I wanted to meet her. And we did. July 14, 1977, we met Lincoln, Nebraska Airport. And if you want a challenge, try reading the Bible's longest chapter from beginning to end, Psalm 119. Now, the Psalms are a little tough to read, and the Proverbs too, because they're not long, continuous stories. Proverbs, you read a couple of verses, and or just a verse, and that's a topic. Then the next verse might be the next topic. So you have to adjust your mind to reading in different genres, just like you have to adjust your mind between poetry and prose and fiction and stuff. But Psalm 119 is the Bible's longest chapter, and as you read, you'll find that pretty much every verse is about the importance and benefits of reading God's word, treasuring God's law. And as you read the Bible as the way it was written, giving yourself patience to adjust to its various writing styles, you will truly discover what David said about God. He is our shepherd. He was a shepherd in the wilderness, and he was a shepherd in Palestine when he walked with real sandals. He is a shepherd today. Our closing song is one of my favorites, the 23rd Psalm, set to rhyme and into a beautiful song. Let's stand and sing it together. It's number 546. 546, the Lord's my shepherd, I'll not want. He makes me down to lie in pastures green. He leads me this quiet waters by. Number 546.